The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 19th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's on top with no clear challenger. What happened? Republican Party leaders were left reeling after the New Hampshire primary this week, with divisive outsider Donald Trump securing an emphatic victory and none of the mainstream candidates garnering enough support to emerge as an obvious rival. The populist billionaire businessman finished with 35% of the vote, far ahead of second-place finisher Ohio Governor John Kasich, who had 16%. Kasich, a moderate, staked his entire campaign on success in the Granite State. Conservative firebrand Texas Senator Ted Cruz came in third with 12%, and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush limped in fourth with 11%. The biggest disappointment was Senator Marco Rubio's fifth-place finish after a disastrous performance in last weekend's debate, in which he repeated the same rehearsed line about President Obama on four separate occasions. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who aggressively pounced on Rubio's repetition gaffe in the debate, finished in sixth place and ended his presidential campaign the following day. Former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina also dropped out after getting just 4%. Trump's triumph laid to rest suspicions raised by his second-place finish in Iowa that his poll numbers exaggerated his actual support. In his victory speech, he vowed to be the greatest jobs president that God ever created and promised, "The world is going to respect us again." Kasich said his victory marked the point at which the light overcame the darkness of negative campaigning. Bush told his supporters that voters were starting to appreciate the importance of governing experience, adding, "This campaign's not dead." Rubio, who had hoped to become the main establishment candidate after his strong third-place showing in Iowa, admitted that his debate performance had hurt him. "I did not do well on Saturday night," he said. "That will never happen again." What the editorial said: Trump's emphatic victory in New Hampshire is an ominous development, said the Los Angeles Times. Republican voters have entrusted their hopes to a demagogue with no experience in government, who demonizes minorities and demeans women. In last weekend's debate, he even promised to reinstitute waterboarding of suspected terrorists and inflict on them a hell of a lot worse. In other words, commit war crimes. Voters are understandably frustrated by the unfulfilled promises of professional politicians, but that frustration doesn't justify supporting a candidate as extreme and dangerous as Trump. The blustery businessman will be particularly pleased no clear alternative emerged, said the Wall Street Journal. Rubio was weakened by his brain freeze in the debate. Kasich poses little threat because his support is largely limited to independents and moderates. Bush and his super PAC spent an astonishing $36 million in New Hampshire for little reward. To have any chance of stopping Trump, they will have to stop attacking one another and go after Trump sooner rather than later. What the columnist said: Trump's decisive victory should be a wake-up call for Republican leadership, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. Terrified that his anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim rhetoric and crude language would doom the party to a disastrous loss in the general election, they've been trying to convince themselves that he cannot and will not win the nomination. But for the Donald to lose, someone actually has to beat him. Trump is polling well in the next primary states. And for all the talk of political lanes, establishment, outsider, and religious conservative, his mastery of broadcast media is winning over many disgruntled voters. His support may grow when other candidates drop out. Almost as astonishing as Trump's victory was the breadth of his support, said Charles Hurt in the Washington Times. Exit polls showed that he won in all demographics that pundits assured us he'd struggle with, including women and college graduates. After all the glee over his second-place finish in Iowa, Trump has shown he has a winning presidential campaign. Kasich's strong finish turns the GOP's Trump-themed headache into a migraine, said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com. With huge war chests and massive ground operations in other states, Rubio and Bush were well-positioned to use the second-place spotlight to finally begin consolidating establishment-minded voters. In contrast, Kasich is almost comically ill-equipped to do so, with little money left and virtually no conservative support. The GOP has to be particularly devastated by Rubio's implosion, said Dana Milbank in WashingtonPost.com. Everyone who has watched the Florida senator on the campaign trail has noticed his robotic repetition of the same canned lines. But with everyone's attention on Trump, Rubio Bot hadn't come under intense scrutiny. The moment the pressure was on, he wilted in the spotlight. Don't write off Rubio just yet, said James Estill in Economist.com. The freshman senator remains clever and attractive, and he has a much better shot at consolidating the party behind him than Cruz, an ultra-conservative whom the party establishment also loathes, or the stilted Bush, who jars with the anti-establishment spirit of the times. But for Rubio to become the mainstream Republican champion, he has to overcome a perception that he is too green to be president. And we have a second main story today. No surprise that it's also political. Sanders win reshapes Democratic race. What happened? Hillary Clinton found herself in a bitter ideological and generational battle for the Democratic presidential nomination this week after Senator Bernie Sanders scored a resounding victory in the New Hampshire primary. A self-proclaimed Democratic socialist, the Vermont senator was expected to win his neighboring state, but the scope of his triumph surprised nearly everyone and raised questions about whether Clinton is still the party's presumptive nominee. Sanders captured 60% of the vote to Clinton's 38%, sweeping every age group but people 65 and over, and winning 83% of voters under 30, roughly the same share as when he narrowly lost last week's Iowa caucuses. Perhaps most worrying for Clinton, Sanders held an 11-point advantage among New Hampshire women. Democrats who consider honesty a key issue went for the senator 93-5. Together, we have sent a message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California, Sanders told jubilant supporters. The senator faces demographic challenges as the campaign moves to the February 20th Nevada caucuses, then to South Carolina and other states with large numbers of black and Hispanic voters who heavily favor Clinton. But he's working to close that gap. After his victory, the senator, the first Jewish candidate to ever win a presidential primary, met with civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton in New York City. Amid reports of a campaign shakeup, Clinton seemed chastened by her landslide loss to a once fringe candidate. "I know I have some work to do, especially with young people," she said. "Even if they are not supporting me now, I am supporting them." What the editorial said. Sanders' win puts a hold on the Clinton coronation, said USA Today. Yes, the former Secretary of State still has undeniable advantages. She has a masterful command of foreign policy, and her pragmatic plans make more sense than Sanders' idealistic proposals, which have been derided, snarkily but not entirely unfairly, as free college, free health care, and a pony. But Clinton's weaknesses, her inability to connect with young voters and women, her six-figure Wall Street speeches, grow clearer by the day. Clinton is misplaying the gender card badly, said the New Hampshire union leader. Her surrogates tried to shame young women who support her rival, and it backfired. Young Sanders supporters say they were offended when feminist icon Gloria Steinem suggested they're only flocking to Sanders to meet boys. And when former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright warned of a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. Clinton might be surprised to learn that some female voters have opinions independent of liberal gender politics. Some are even conservatives. What the columnist said: young female Sanders backers probably like the cool old guy because he's promising to take from the rich and give to the poor, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Robin Hood is so awesome, isn't he? While Bernie Sanders talking revolution, Clinton, ever the adult in the room, may be doomed by her own sober momliness. Her feminist allies, meanwhile, are victims of their own hard-won victories. Millennial women have never known a world in which they were not treated to daily doses of go-girl power. They can have it all, including the choice not to vote for a woman just because she's a woman, because, after all, this would be sexist. Clinton is still the overwhelming favorite, said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com, but she has real reason to worry. You simply can't discount the scale of her defeat. While Sanders did benefit from near native son status, New Hampshire wasn't hostile territory for Clinton. It's where she beat Obama in 2008, her big comeback after finishing third in Iowa. This loss should sting. But Bernie supporters shouldn't celebrate just yet, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. His New Hampshire coalition will be hard to replicate in upcoming races. Exit polls show his Granite State supporters were younger, whiter, more likely to identify as independent, and more opposed to gun control than the rest of the Democratic base. We'll have to wait until Nevada and South Carolina to find out whether Sanders is bringing a new Democratic coalition together or tearing at the existing one. And our controversy of the week: Hillary Clinton, too cozy with Wall Street? Hillary Goldman Clinton has a big money problem, said Derek Hunter in townhall.com. In the debates last week before his blowout win in New Hampshire, Senator Bernie Sanders repeatedly challenged Clinton to explain how she could claim to be running as a progressive champion of working people when she has accepted $21.4 million in campaign donations from Wall Street banks, more than 10% of her total haul, and personally pocketed $675,000 for giving three speeches to Goldman Sachs, an institution more demonized on the left than anything this side of the Koch brothers. Clinton's in a bind, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Out of her terror of losing to Sanders, she's echoing his populist rhetoric about breaking up banks and jailing their employees. But thanks to her deep and long-standing ties to the banks, no one believes her. Her lame explanation of those whopping fees from Goldman: well, I don't know, that's what they offered, will hardly allay voters' suspicions that she's in Wall Street's pocket. Say what you like about the traders at Goldman Sachs, they have a keen sense of value, and they're not trading $675,000 for the entertainment value of Hillary Clinton appearances. Clinton is hardly alone in taking checks from Wall Street, said Bill Scheer in RealClearPolitics.com. Liberal champions Barack Obama, Franklin Roosevelt, and Theodore Roosevelt all accepted major campaign contributions from the big banks and financial firms, and all successfully imposed regulations on corporations anyway. When banks and other corporations make large political donations to Democrats, what they expect in return is access, a chance to have their concerns heard, rather than any straight-up quid pro quo. There's an irony in Sanders attacking Clinton for her Wall Street ties, said Jeff Stein in Vox.com. Her plans to regulate Wall Street are not only more aggressive than his, breaking up the biggest banks, imposing new taxes and regulation across the financial sector, but also vastly more detailed and realistic. As she put it delicately in her New Hampshire concession speech, "I will fight to rein in Wall Street, and you know what? I know how to do it." That assurance sounds pretty empty, said Catherine Timpf in NationalReview.com, especially since Clinton is refusing to release the transcripts of her speeches Goldman paid her $675,000 to deliver. Goldman employees told Politico.com this week that the speeches were practically pep talks for the beleaguered financial sector. "It was pretty glowing about us," said one employee who witnessed the speech. She sounded more like a Goldman Sachs managing director. In the heat of this heated primary race, with Democrats in an anti-establishment mood, transcripts of Hillary going on and on about how stupid it was for people to be bashing big banks could be fatal to her candidacy. "What's so puzzling about Clinton's handling of the Goldman issue," said Janelle Ross in WashingtonPost.com, "is that she seems so unprepared to address it. As with her email scandal, she's giving defensive and evasive answers to questions she should have known were coming. Despite decades in public life, she still demonstrates a remarkable capacity to escalate rather than effectively address controversies over her actions. Clinton will probably survive the Goldman mess, as she survived so many scandals in the past," said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. "But she's taking another hit to her damaged credibility, and it will further sap the momentum of her campaign. If Clinton faces a deficit of enthusiasm among voters in the fall, she'll only have herself to blame." It was a good week for honesty. After Carolina Panthers quarterback Cam Newton explained why he walked out of a post-Super Bowl press conference after his team lost to the Denver Broncos 24-10. "I'm a sore loser," Newton said. "Who likes to lose?" It was a good week for rarefied air after a British entrepreneur began selling $115 jars of English countryside air that has passed over babbling brooks to wealthy residents of pollution-choked Chinese cities. And it was a good week for 19th century workmanship after a 155-year-old mousetrap successfully ensnared a rodent while on display in a British museum. The Victorian-era trap wasn't baited and was not intended for pest control, though its label does promise that the device will last a lifetime. But it was a bad week for a bite on the go after Joshua James, 23, was arrested for throwing a live 3.5-foot alligator through the drive-thru window of a Florida's Wendy's. "He does stuff like this because he thinks it's funny," said his mother, Linda James, calling her son stupid. It was a bad week for Russia's morality police after stories about the unexpected close friendship between a male goat and the male tiger that was meant to eat him at a zoo near Vladivostok prompted a prosecutor to investigate whether the media was trying to provoke interest in non-traditional sexual relations and turn children gay. And it was a bad week for sleeping around after reports of bedbug infestations at New York City hotels, including five-star destinations like the Waldorf Astoria and Marriott Marquis, increased by 44% over the past year. Experts say the biting pests have developed an immunity to pesticides. On the briefing page, America's Opioid Epidemic. By freely doling out prescription painkillers, doctors have fueled a crisis of addiction and deadly overdoses. How many people are dying? A record 47,000 Americans fatally overdosed in 2014, a 7% increase over the previous year. That's about 1.5 times as many as died in car crashes or in gun violence. This epidemic isn't being driven by illicit drugs, but by a surge in the use of prescription opioid painkillers. Nearly 1.9 million Americans now abuse or are dependent on legal opioids, according to the government statistics. And last year, 19,000 people fatally overdosed on prescription painkillers, up 16% from 2013. Addiction experts say doctors have fueled this crisis by recommending that patients with even minor ailments and aches take highly addictive opioids like Vicodin, Percocet, and OxyContin. Physicians wrote 259 million opioid prescriptions in 2012, triple the number 2 decades ago, and enough to provide every adult in the country with a bottle of these pills. We have now this incredibly unusual public health crisis, says substance abuse expert Meldon Cahan, that's essentially caused by the physicians. Why do doctors prescribe opioids? Opium poppy-based drugs are one of the world's oldest numbing painkillers. Laudanum has been used as an analgesic since the 1500s. And heroin was sold in the U.S. to treat menstrual pain until the 1920s, when Congress banned the drug because of its highly addictive qualities. When semi-synthetic opioids like oxycodone and hydrocodone, found in Percocet and Vicodin respectively, were first approved in the mid-20th century, they were recommended only for managing pain during terminal illnesses such as cancer, or for acute short-term pain, like recovery from surgery, to ensure patients wouldn't get addicted. But in the 1990s, doctors came under increasing pressure to use opioids to treat the millions of Americans suffering from chronic, non-malignant conditions, like back pain and osteoarthritis. Influential New York-based pain specialist Dr. Russell Portnoy helped lead the campaign. He claimed prescription opioids were a gift from nature and assured his fellow doctors, based on a 1986 study of only 38 patients, that fewer than 1% of long-term users become addicted. Purdue Pharma, a major pharmaceutical company, made similar claims. Why did Purdue say that? It was marketing a new powerful time-released opioid, OxyContin. When OxyContin went on sale in 1996, Purdue launched a promotional campaign unlike anything we have ever really seen, says opioid abuse expert Dr. Andrew Kolodny. The company gave doctors 34,000 coupons for free OxyContin prescriptions, bombarded them with branded stuffed toys and coffee mugs, and aggressively promoted the idea that the new drug, which is stronger than morphine, was both safe and highly effective. Drug reps were going to family care doctors and insisting that OxyContin had no real risks, only benefits, said Kolodny. Purdue pleaded guilty in 2007 to criminal charges that it misled regulators, doctors, and patients about OxyContin's addictive qualities. By that point, hundreds of thousands of Americans were hooked. Why are opioids so dangerous? Opioids produce a powerful sense of euphoria in many users that leaves them feeling numb and carefree. But the journal American Family Physician notes that as little as 2 weeks of opioid treatment can produce drug tolerance in some patients, meaning they need larger doses to get the same effect. The cycle of craving and tolerance can have deadly consequences. In large doses, prescription painkillers can slow down the respiratory system so much that the person stops breathing. Painkiller users also often mix opioids with other substances that can raise the risk of an overdose. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that 31% of prescription painkiller deaths in 2011 involved anti-anxiety sedatives such as Valium or Xanax. What's being done to help? Authorities have cracked down on so-called pill mills, clinics that make a fortune out of mass prescribing opioids. But studies show that it is family doctors and internists who write the vast majority of opioid prescriptions. Most states have now set up databases that keep track of who has received prescriptions for addictive painkillers, so physicians can check if a patient is doctor shopping and getting pills at multiple locations. The Obama administration is also seeking $1.1 billion in funding to increase opioid prescribing training and to give addicts better access to medication-assisted treatment. But by making opioids harder to get legally, authorities will inevitably push some addicts toward heroin. How can doctors stem the epidemic? They could write fewer prescriptions, or at least stop providing opioids to people who have already overdosed. A recent study found that 91% of people who had suffered a non-fatal overdose on opioids got another painkiller prescription soon after. In 70% of those cases, the physician who wrote the refill prescription also wrote the prescription before the overdose. But if doctors do cut back on opioid prescriptions, one big problem remains. The 100 million Americans who say they suffer from chronic pain and are desperate for relief. What are you going to do with a 40-year-old truck driver who has chronic back pain and takes OxyContin without problems so he can work? Drug addiction expert David Courtwright told Pacific Standard, "The problem is that, for some, opioids are just fine. And for others, they will ruin their lives and possibly kill them. Essentially, we are playing Russian roulette with prescriptions." Opioids, a gateway to heroin. The crackdown on opioid prescriptions has had a deadly unintended consequence. It has made heroin more popular. As regulation of prescription painkillers has tightened and pill mills have been shut down, an increasing number of addicts have been driven to look for opioids on the black market. And then, inevitably, for heroin, which at $5 a bag is much cheaper than a $40 pill. People eventually say, why am I paying $1 per milligram of Oxy when for a tenth of the price I can get an equivalent dose of heroin? Says addiction specialist Dr. Jason Jerry. The consequences of heroin's newfound popularity are predictably grim. While annual deaths from opioid painkillers slowly increased between 2010 and 2014, rising from 16,000 to 19,000, heroin-related deaths in the same period rocketed from 3,000 to nearly 11,000 a year. Four out of five of those heroin addicts were hooked on opioids first. Moving on now to the best columns. We'll take two from the U.S. this week. The first, the fight the U.S. can't avoid. President Obama came into office assuring Americans that the tide of war is receding, said Jackson Deal. Obama has stubbornly stuck to his ideological opposition to U.S. military engagement in the Middle East, regardless of contradictory facts on the ground, namely the descent of Syria and Iraq into bloody sectarian chaos, the rise of ISIS, and the alarming gains of the Taliban in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, U.S. generals are warning that the planned reduction of American forces to just 5,500 by the end of the year could lead to an Afghan military collapse. In the fight against ISIS, the Pentagon is pleading for thousands of additional military trainers and special operations soldiers to help Iraqi and Kurdish forces retake the city of Mosul and other occupied regions. The Pentagon has also called for military intervention in chaotic Libya, where radicals affiliated with ISIS threaten to turn a large part of the country into a terrorist stronghold. U.S. military power cannot bring peace and democracy to the region, but it can make a decisive difference in whether radical Islamists wind up running much of it. In his final year in office, will a president who dreamed of ending the wars adjust his foreign policy to an unwelcome reality? The false god of pious politicians. Presidential candidates should cut the god talk, says Cal Thomas. Republicans Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio frequently pander to Christian conservative audiences by adopting the tone and terminology of evangelical preachers, while Hillary Clinton often claims that her Methodist faith helped shape her liberalism. Even Donald Trump has gotten into the act, waving a Bible and pretending he knows what it says. While I myself share the traditional beliefs of evangelical Christians, my faith doesn't qualify me to be an auto mechanic or NBA center or president. If candidates truly knew their Bible, they'd know that Jesus told Pontius Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world," and said of taxes, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's." Too many conservative Christians have fallen into the trap of believing God is a Republican and of personally demonizing President Obama, rather than praying for him. Obama, not incidentally, models family better than many Republicans, particularly the thrice-married Trump. Presidential candidates should tell us what they do to address the nation's problems and leave the piety to the preachers. And a international column, How They See Us. Washington can't stop Pyongyang. North Korea is thumbing its nose at the U.S., said Tong Kim in the Korea Times. In the past month, Pyongyang has carried out a nuclear bomb test and tested a long-range missile under cover of launching a satellite. But the United Nations Security Council hasn't yet passed sanctions because the U.S. and China, North Korea's main backer, can't agree on what to do. Secretary of State John Kerry has listed numerous ways China could punish its client state by restricting Pyongyang's movement of ships and planes, hitting its banking sector, and denying its oil and coal. But Beijing is not ready to bear economic and political costs by cutting off trade with North Korea, fearing that the collapse of Kim Jong-un's regime would send a flood of refugees its way. With China refusing to act and little evidence that further U.S. sanctions would hurt North Korea, only an American offer of unconditional talks will bring Pyongyang back to the nuclear negotiating table. The North is ready to talk, said Kim Jong-hee. Writing in nknews.org, a U.S.-based analysis site, a North Korean official floated a plan to sign a peace treaty, offering a nuclear moratorium in exchange for an end to U.S.-South Korean military drills. He specifically cited North Korea's status as a nuclear power, implying that the North has become strong enough to ignore China's warnings and that it wants to negotiate with the United States on equal footing. We may be able to finally to start thinking about peace on the Korean Peninsula. Someday, maybe, said Duga Ilbo in an editorial. But right now, we need to be able to defend ourselves from a deranged, nuclear-armed enemy on our border. Ahead of the latest missile test, Japan vowed to shoot down any missile that entered its territory. And it has the missile defense capability to do so. We don't. That's why Washington and Seoul are now opening talks on installing an advanced new missile defense system capable of intercepting warheads at high altitudes. Our government has also pledged to install a new defense system to target lower altitude missiles, but there are doubts it has put enough cash aside for the project. Our leaders must find that money. It is reckless for South Korea to depend only on the U.S. for national defense. We can no longer count on America at all, said Chosun Ilbo. The U.S. has passed the buck for taming North Korea to China, and China is sitting on its hands. Next, we can expect Pyongyang to develop a small warhead that can be launched on a missile. Then what? Judging by Washington's inaction on Ukraine and Syria, it would probably respond only after Seoul has turned into a pile of smoldering ashes. It's time for South Korea to take the biggest step of all and start talking about developing its own nuclear weapons. Turn now to the last word, titled today, A T-Rex of One's Own. Movie stars, hedge fund moguls, and oil-rich sheiks are paying top dollar for dinosaur fossils in private auctions. Reporter Laurie Gwynn Shapiro investigates the lure of owning ancient bones. The world's most famous paleontologist doesn't understand why anyone wants to collect dinosaurs. Mark Norell sits across from me in his expansive corner office at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City and launches right in. People are weird. I think, who is buying this? I first heard about private dinosaur collecting in 2007 when the actors Leonardo DiCaprio and Nicolas Cage engaged in a bidding war over a 32-inch Tyrannosaurus Batar skull at an auction in Beverly Hills. In the end, Cage outbid his rival with a $276,000 offer. Just before Christmas 2015, Cage returned it on an order form from the Department of Homeland Security. Unbeknownst to him, he had bought a dinosaur part smuggled out of Mongolia. Since that auction, I perk up whenever I see news about any other big-name dinosaur collectors. The film directors James Cameron and Ron Howard, actor Brad Pitt, and Nathan Myhrvold, Microsoft's former technology officer, who, according to Men's Journal, has a Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton in a glass solarium in his large home in Bellevue, Washington. Various high-flying sheiks are in on the pastime, too. Former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich keeps a T-Rex skull cast in his office. As I read more about this current crop of rich male, always male it seems, collectors, I gave them their own species name, Abundus egocentris. I tried to understand their motivation. Was having a big, vicious dinosaur on display akin to owning a huge, scary dog like a Rottweiler? Were they saying to the world, "Look what I can tame"? Or maybe there were deeper psychological implications. Did collecting dinosaur fossils tap into childhood issues, delivering a soothing narrative about where we came from? My first step in getting answers was to talk to the person Time magazine nicknamed Dino Man, Who better to explain the mindset of those amassing dinosaur bones than the man who oversees the dinosaurs that attract 5 million visitors a year? Norrell, age 58, surprisingly chatty and undeniably hip, is chairman of the museum's Division of Paleontology. He's best known for excavating dinosaurs sitting on nests, baby dino embryos fossilized beneath their haunches, not to mention his storied work on feathered theropods. Just back on a fossil tour of China, Norrell was getting ready to go out in the field again, somewhere in the Gobi Desert. In preparation, I had swiftly transformed myself into a walking version of the complete idiot's guide to dinosaurs and the relatively brief history of humans collecting their bones. In the 1870s, a fossil collecting frenzy that had sprung up in Great Britain spread across the pond and found its way westward into northern Wyoming. There, an extreme rivalry brewed between two titans of early U.S. paleontology, Edward Drinker Cope and Othniel Charles Marsh. Historians refer to their long, ugly feud, which saw them jostling for scientific supremacy and using underhanded methods to discredit each other, as the Bone Wars. Despite their enmity, between them they'd named 136 dinosaur species by 1892. The collecting mania in the U.S. intensified again at the tail end of the 19th century. On December 11, 1898, the New York Journal and Advertiser ran a headline that caught the fancy of many, including the philanthropist Andrew Carnegie. "Most colossal animal ever on Earth just found out west." The titillating copy featured a Brontosaurus gigantus peering into the New York Life building to illustrate the size of the find. It was not a factual story. Only a single leg bone was found in Laramie, Wyoming, but the filthy rich Carnegie was now longing for a dinosaur of his own. He financed great discoveries, including Dippy, Diplodocus Carnegie, composed of bones unearthed along Sheep Creek in Wyoming, and a startlingly large dinosaur that he named for his wife, Apatosaurus luisa, pieced together from the finds in his private quarry in Vernal, Utah. In Norrell's view, dinosaur collectors today are not merely harmless science wannabes. They cause serious sorus for those who in the museum world. Prices have ballooned for the finds on private lands. Museums don't have the funds to compete with the actors and hedge fund guys. If there is a great amateur discovery, don't you think it should advance science? He also pooh-poohs reports that you can make a fortune in dinosaurs because, as he puts it, you can always get more for a Cerat than for a Stegosaurus. And keep in mind that they are incredibly not liquid. You can't say, "Oh, I need some money. I'm going to sell my Bamprotosaur." The highest priced dinosaur ever offered by a private seller was Sue, the largest T-Rex specimen ever found, which back in 1997 reportedly even attracted a bid from Michael Jackson. After the pandemonium died down, the Field Museum of Chicago was the victor. What's $8 million in change to someone who invests in art? And that sale was a one-off. It really didn't happen again, Norrell sniffs. More recently, Bonhams in New York touted the auction of a theropod and a large horned ceratopsian locked in mortal combat. "Well, let me tell you what the auction houses won't tell you," he continues. "For all that publicity, it was a no-go. The guys who excavated it thought they'd go to the Bahamas forever. Instead, they didn't make reserve." Norrell doesn't own any dinosaurs. As part of any museum contract, no curator can collect in his or her study area, or authenticate or appraise fossils for private sale. As for the specimens that surround Norrell now at the museum, I guess there are a few around here that are cool, but I sure as hell wouldn't want any of them in my house. I press him. What motivates the collectors? Honestly, some people are rabid collectors and some people aren't. He raises a finger. But there's another segment I've come across, especially in the fossil world, which is kind of like hoarders. All they want is more stuff. I have been in people's houses where every possible inch of their home is covered in fossils. Even the dishwasher has trilobites in it. If you want to really get into the head of the collectors, Norell advises, meet with some private dealers to get their perspective. I'll forewarn you, though, some are shadier than others, and there is a hidden world of secretive dealers, average Joes without a store who trade at fossil shows. Almost a Silk Road of dinosaur dealing. A lot of the visible trading happens in Tucson at an annual mineral and fossil show held in February. People come from all over the world. They always have someone there from Homeland Security and ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Norell says. As Nicolas Cage found out, even big-time buyers can fall foul of anti-smuggling laws. Some of the sellers can knowingly skirt the law. Crazy stuff goes to Dubai, to Qatar, and pretty regularly to Singapore. And there are all sorts of big, odd collections in Germany, Norell tells me. Despite his gripes, he says he genuinely likes some of the private fossil dealers. Plenty of dino dealing takes place right near my Manhattan home. A year prior to my conversation with Norell, I'd seen a Velociraptor claw for sale in a fine gem store on Fifth Avenue, across the street from Lord & Taylor. Astro Gallery of Gems is the largest gem and mineral store in the world, whose devoted clients have included Salvador Dali and John Lennon. As I suspected, it is also a dinosaur dealership on the side. Dinosaurs are not as easy sales as you think, Dennis Tajiloff, the 48-year-old president and CEO, confides to me. His subterranean office is heavily guarded with expensive digital security. This netherworld below the upstairs public gallery is filled with glinting gemstones and a strange assortment of ancient bones. Tajiloff notices me eyeing a pterodactyl-like skeleton a few feet away. You like my little guy? He's an Odontopterix toleopica, a prehistoric waterfowl. $125,000. Tajiloff describes his ideal dinosaur customer as a grown-up boy who never got over the revelation that prehistoric creatures were real, or that they were on this planet so many million years ago. I agree that we all know that kid who picks his favorite dinosaurs, learns their names and families. Yes, that's the one. And he's gotten slightly older. He began to process what 200 million years means, and was still enraptured by the thought of a creature that ate 3 tons of vegetation a day and needed 3,000 teeth to chew dinner. These days, Tajiloff mostly buys and sells fossils dug out of private property and makes no apologies. He also sources fossils directly from paleontologists and geologists, other fossil dealers, and old collections. Sometimes people have to be reminded that dinosaurs are not in danger of going extinct, you know. They already are. So you are not hurting any creature by selling, trading, or looking for dinosaur fossils. In that way, it is also just like gem collecting. On the flip side, he doesn't peddle to U.S. museums because they are federally funded and, frankly, do not have much money. Once again, the obsession of the collector and the obsession of the scientist are at odds. I mentioned that Norell doesn't think much of fossils as investments. Tajiloff gleams his teeth at me, shaking his head in disagreement. Scientists don't want to put a value on the dinosaurs. They consider them national treasures for scientific reasons. They don't like a wealthy person taking what they think belongs to everyone to see and enjoy. Still, Tajiloff tells me, most of his clients take pride in their collecting choices, and many end up donating their fossils to research. About 80% of the time, A buyer won't hold on to his precious bones until the bitter end, despite his initial swagger. So they ultimately end up in a museum or university anyway. Dinosaur collectors are proving not as easy to classify as I'd hoped. Some people want to possess the best, it seems. Some want to be seen as generous benefactors. And despite what Norell told me, I'm realizing that old-fashioned market speculation is another distinct motivation. My dinosaurs don't have quarterly reviews, but look at the past 30 years. What you could have bought back then, and what it would cost you now? Even with inflation, the compound is astronomical, Tangeloff says. And the numbers today are staggering. There are people spending way more than James Cameron. Some of my best dinosaur clients have very, very large homes. As I wrap up my visit, my host ponders a jawbone sitting in his inbox and offers another theory. I strongly believe that this is just the beginning of a craze. I think that because the world is so techie and we all live behind screens, that people are really going back to nature. I sell thousands of little fossils a week. We had a section called Astro Kids in the old FAO Schwartz toy store. And when they relaunch next year, we'll be back. Boys who love dinosaurs, they're our future customers. This was excerpted from an article that was originally published by Aeon Media, a digital magazine for ideas and culture. Follow them on Twitter at AEONMag. We're on the health and science page now. First, exercise has limited weight loss benefits. Running that extra mile on the treadmill may not make you any thinner, a new study suggests, because exercise alone can burn only a limited number of calories. Instead, the body actually adapts to greater levels of activity, which may help explain why people who are trying to lose weight often hit a frustrating plateau. The research team followed more than 300 men and women from five different countries over the course of 1 week, measuring their daily activity level and energy expenditure. As expected, people who were moderately active, walking a couple of miles daily or working out for half an hour two or three times a week, burned about 200 more calories than the ones who remained sedentary. But intense activity didn't necessarily reap more benefits. Participants who logged the highest levels of physical exertion expended about the same amount of energy as those who were only moderately active. The researchers suggest that the bodies of extremely active people learn to use energy more efficiently during exercise and to burn fewer calories while at rest. We think this is a really common evolutionary adaptation that all animals use to keep from outstripping their resources and to keep from starving, study author Herman Pontzer of Hunter College in New York City tells CNN.com. Exercise can provide many health benefits, including weight loss. Pontzer says, but to shed a lot of pounds, you probably ought to focus on changing your diet and watching how much you eat. And the health scare of the week, marijuana affects memory. Many marijuana smokers enjoy the drug's short-term high, but a new study reveals that weed may also wreak long-term havoc on the brain. Specifically, researchers found that years of pot smoking could hinder people's ability to recall certain words. The team tracked the marijuana use of nearly 3,400 men and women over the course of 25 years. At the end of the study, the subjects were tested on their verbal memory, mental processing speed, and executive function. For every 5 years of exposure to marijuana, the study found, one out of two smokers remembered one word fewer from a list of 15, a small but statistically significant effect. Marijuana use didn't affect other areas of brain function, But the more pot people smoked, the worse they performed on memory tests. Recreational marijuana users use it to get high to benefit from the transient change it produces. The lead author, Rito Auer, of the University of Lausanne in Switzerland, tells Reuters.com. But this transient effect might have long-term consequences on the way the brain processes information, and could also have direct toxic effects on neurons. And we're down to time for just some short notes. After pressure from U.S. government officials concerning ISIS's recruiting through social media, Twitter has suspended more than 125,000 accounts for promoting or threatening terrorism. In Mexico, 93% of all crimes are not even reported because of a lack of trust in authorities, according to a new report by the University of the Americas Puebla. Of the cases that are filed, fewer than 5% result in convictions. Overall, the report said, the chance of paying a penalty for breaking the law in Mexico is 1%. On the poll watch, 91% of Americans followed news about the 2016 presidential race last week, with 24% citing cable news and 14% naming social media as the most helpful sources of information. 82% of voters age 18 to 29 prefer a presidential nominee who agrees with them on almost all the issues to one who has a greater chance of winning. Among voters 65 and up, 41% prefer a nominee with the best chance of winning. And finally, a quote from David Bowie. Aging is an extraordinary process whereby you become the person that you always should have been. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.